checks whether it can perhaps open a file and do a few other things, checks the system load average to see if it's within reasonable limits. And if these things turn out to be not within reasonable values, it will try and fork off a child process and execute the whole program to, reboot to reboot the machine. If it can't reboot the machine, or if it's if Watchdog itself hangs so badly that it can't even perform its checks, which can happen perhaps if you have a kernel bug, then the Watchdog daemon will be unable to write to this device driver, in which case the kernel code will see that as minutes has passed with no writes, and will then trigger an immediate reboot. So this would be a hard reboot with no signal files, etc. It will just stop itself and restart. Of course, this doesn't necessarily cater for the situation of kernel bugs. So there are some hardware devices you can purchase. I think there's about four or five of them supported in the standard kernel log source tree. And these are hardware devices which implement the same functionality. So when you write to the slash dev slash watchdog device driver, data will be written to the hardware. And if the hardware sees that no data has been written to it for a certain period of time, then it will trigger the reset line on the bus and reset the machine that way. And so that way, even if Linux itself is hung so badly that it can't reboot itself, we'll have hardware do it for you. And so with a program like this, I mean, you'd have Watchdog also watching the spaces and file systems. I mean, maybe there could be two potential issues with space being seeded. One is a program has become wedged somehow and gone into a loop, in which case a reboot might fix it. This isn't what you want to do, but in some situations it's better than having the machine go down entirely. In that case, of course, being an attacker. So you'd have Watchdog reboot the machine and then have another process automatically notify you, and you could then do whatever it seems to be appropriate. And also, it wouldn't be that hard to configure Watchdog to detect certain operations and decide to halt the machine instead of rebooting it, if that meets your requirements. But again, these issues aren't really SLINX issues. These are just general Unix administration issues, I think. Do you have any more questions at this stage? Yep. Hang on. When you say auditing, are you referring to the SELinux auditing? Maybe. There's two uses of auditing. One is to develop policy, because you need to know what's not being permitted so you can develop policy. The second is you need to know what's being done to your machine. If you see someone trying to do things like read the shadow file and doing various other operations, you might conclude that this person is perhaps hostile and therefore deserves to be watched closely or possibly removed from the system. So, for example, if you see someone within the space of 1 second try to read the shadow file, try to write to the slash dev directory and write to the slash bin directory, you can be almost certain they're trying to install a rootkit. And so you see those operations, then you know this person is a hostile person. And so auditing in that case is used to detect hostile people and then to take appropriate action. So I think in terms of actual real use of SELinux, most people who read the audit logs, we read in terms of security and access control of their system, not in terms of developing policy. Because in a small minority of people that were actually developing policy. But have you got more to ask? Yes, the less rules, the less things that are being audited, the harder it will be to overflow logs. You're correct in that. Also, in the default policy, all things that happen routinely are generally have a don't audit rule for them. So in normal operation system, you don't have that many things being audited. And also, in enforcing mode, an operation will generally only be logged a limited number of times. So there's rate limiting for logs, so you're not going to perform the same operation 1,000 times with 1,000 log entries. So this combination means that you don't get that many log entries, but you do get one of each item that's being refused. So you can see what the person's trying to do without having your logs overflowing too easily. I think we're using SELinux, it's very hard to actually fill your bar log partition with ordered entries. I think there are many easier ways of filling the logs. best way is finding some daemon that logs fairly verbosely and just send messages to it. Yep. Okay. When I'm running policy, I don't want to do it in that way. I'm sure you, when you have daemons that are already configured to run shared rooted, it's often easiest for us to write policy to work with that and make a shared rooted a little more secure. So, for example, a shared rooted daemon can normally run PS and see all processes, so you don't permit that. And a daemon that's shared rooted, if it's running, it can kill other processes of the same UID, or it can, if it's root, it can kill other processes of any UID. So we don't want to permit that either. And so we can use these things as restricted search route more than would otherwise be restricted. But I think the best way to do it is, in many cases, programs run search route under non-SE Linux can be run without search route under SE Linux and have SE Linux only controlling it. So, for example, with the Debian configuration of Postfix, if you're using a search route, the system boot scripts want to copy the files of the search route every time, which is kind of annoying to get it working. So instead of perhaps trying to munge those scripts and make them work in the SE Linux way, I just configured Postfix on my machines to not use search root, because SE Linux restricts it more than search root would. So in a search root, you're restricted to the subset of the files, and they still interact with other processes, still cover the process, might have the same UID, etc. So there's still a lot of things they can do. Whereas with SE Linux, the only thing they can do under SE Linux with no search root, they couldn't do with search root, is read the shared objects under /lib. And generally there's nothing secret there, so I think that overall the SE Linux with no search root is more restrictive and therefore better for security. What you do, if you want to access one directory tree, you just know the types of files and directories that use that tree and have allow rules allowing access to those types. Also, of course, in many cases, you don't want to allow access to all and just have certain types. So with Postfix policy, I think there's about 5 or 6 different types that I'm using for different files and school directories. And so different processes within Postfix have access to those files. So processes can't necessarily access files created by another Postfix process. That means that the process of the mail going through the system goes through process A, which can bind to the port, which is the process master, which spawns the child process. The child process that's receiving the data can talk via TCP to the outside world, write to a spool file. And then the process is launched, which reaches that spool file, and writes to a different spool file it's being routed. And so that way it has to go through a defined order. And if you're trying to exploit Postfix, you want to exploit the Postfix post-drop program, which actually writes the file to his home directory or calls procmail, and you have to exploit the process right through Postfix. So you either have to craft some data to directly exploit the final program post-drop after passing through all the other programs, which I think will be fairly challenging because I think that post-drop is probably the most audited program in Postfix. Or alternately, you have to exploit it every step along the way, which I think will be next to impossible. So exploiting Postfix is going to be very hard because of all the controls. Yes? The SE Linux audit logs have a common format. I'll show you them later on. I might just skip forward to it now. Okay, so here's a sample of SE Linux audit data. I think there have been a few minor changes since we've gone to the kernel audit subsystem. So there's more data available and it's a little different. But this is the general format. So you've got a message saying audit. In brackets we have the number of seconds since, when was it, 1970? Including milliseconds. Colon 0 is in case we have more than one message logged within a certain millisecond. make sure we have a unique identifier for each audit message. We've got ABC, which is the access vector cache, which is the kernel code nested Linux that manages access. It's saying it's a denied operation. I've got the operation snipe, which is a write. Got the pin of the process, which is useful for long-running processes. Of course, there's no use for a process that's launched, tries something and immediately exits. But it can be useful. Got the name of the executable, in which case it's vim. The name of the target that's being accessed, which in this case is etc. The device of the file system in question, so it's HDA1. In this case, I as the administrator happen to know /dev/HDA1 is my root file system. So it's a file named etc on the root file system. Got the inode of it. The source context, which is root identity, user_role, user_tdomain. Target context, the context of the object being accessed. System_u, object_r, and etc_t. And the class of this is directory. So even though we don't have the path, I can be pretty sure this will be my /etc directory. Ls minus id /etc will then reveal the inode for the number for the etc directory, which will then show it to be that this is the directory in question. As you can see, this is a standard format used for all the Linux audit messages, because every message will have the same fields: source context, target context, the object class, whether it's denied or allowed the operation that's allowed or denied. You notice that the write is within the curly braces. This is to indicate, this is because there may be more than one operation denied. For example, if I try to open a file in read-write mode and neither read nor write is permitted, both read and write will be listed as denied operations. So there are a few variable fields, that is, such as the inode number and device node, which don't apply to all operations. For example, the inode number or the device node won't apply for network operations. But for the main fields, they're always there, and it's a fixed format. It should be fairly easy to parse through Perl program, etc. Hang on, I had a question at the back, I think. Someone at the back had a question? No? Okay. Okay, when you try and access via a symbolic link, firstly you're accessing a symbolic link, and you access the symbolic link is permitted, because you create the symbolic link and have full access to it. Then you try to access the shadow file, which you're not permitted to access. So your access to the shadow file will be logged. So the fact that you go through one symbolic link or three symbolic links that you own to get there makes no difference at all. This is probably what you're expecting me to say, weren't you? Okay, yes? Yes. We can infer that from the name of the process being vim. But from this log entry, we don't know necessarily whether it's creating a file, renaming a file, creating a directory. They will always turn the same result. But before we know vim, what it does is it tries to create a temporary file, and that's what we'll be doing in this case. Yes, question? Sorry, I couldn't hear the last bit. Yep. Okay, the question is whether a package of software can include this Linux policy. In theory it can. In practice, no one's done it yet. And also in practice, I would prefer it if it doesn't happen, because I'm expecting that most people who try to do this wouldn't write very good policy, and could possibly break the system in very nasty ways, including breaking other parts of policy, which would then get people reporting bugs to me, that policy I wrote, when it's really someone else's policy. So for all open source software, the thing to do is to send the policy to the SLinux mailing list, and then have it included in the standard policy tree, and then your problem solved. If you're writing policy for a proprietary program, that's another issue, of course. Again, I'm it might work okay to have a proprietary package having proprietary policy to match installed in a RPM or Debian package. I think it's probably best to have them installed separately, however, and not tie the policy to the program. One issue is that you might want to upgrade them separately. If there's changes to the core policy, that might require changes to the policy for a daemon, even though the daemon itself hasn't changed. So if you make changes to perhaps the way logging works, you might allow the policy to work with the new logging mechanism, even though the daemon itself is writing the same files in the same way. So in that case, we might want to upgrade policy without upgrading the package itself. So I think having them separately would be a better operation in that regard. But it's technically possible. So if you want to ignore my advice and go ahead and do it, you can make it work, yeah. Yep. Yep, you can do that. I agree. I think it will be a better option if you're going to do package policy to have a Apache SE Linux package, for example, which depends on the Apache package and provides a policy for it. I think that would be a better option. But I'm still a bit nervous about people having packages of policy. Yep? Yes? Yep? Yeah, so... yes. If you do install a strict policy in Fedora, for example, by default you'll get the policy binary, which has every policy for every program that might be included in Fedora compiled into it, and that'll take about 6 to 7 megabytes of kernel memory. You can then install the policy sources package, which has all the same source, and then you can delete or files that apply to you or move them to a directory book unused, and then compile another policy, and that can be much smaller. So some of my machines, I have a binary policy of 1 megabyte or less, because that's all I'm going to use these machines for. I know what I'm doing, so I just delete things I don't need. And you do the same thing. Doing similar work, a couple of years ago, I got SE Linux working on a Hewlett-Packard IPAC device. This is a machine with 64 megs of RAM, and no swap, and only has 32 megs of storage, and this is running fine on that. Naturally, of course, I tune the policy quite a lot to get the minimum size, because I end up having about 1.3 megs of kernel memory being taken up by SE Linux altogether. So it's the policy binary plus all the other memory it uses, which was not too bad. So 1.3 megs out of 64, and the machine still runs reasonably well, and I don't have any programs crash from memory. But obviously, if you lost 6 megs of a machine that size, you have a serious problem. Yep. Yep. Yeah, if the file still exists, of course, that's easy to do. If the file doesn't exist, that's more of a problem. I believe that with the audit subsystem coming in, there's more complete log data becoming available, and so SE Linux is can be adjusted to use some of this data and perhaps have more complete information. At the moment, in some cases, SE Linux is called only to give partial information about the file, and it doesn't go to the effort of searching through the similar kernel data structures to try and find or infer the rest of the data. So it just reports what it's given. But I believe the plans are to increase this information. Okay. Yes? Sure. The question is, can you write code to change for a different context user role? It's very easy to do. There is an API defined for this, so there's a library call you can make to set the context for a new process to execute. Also, you don't even need to do it in that mechanism. You can do it from a shell script. Under the proc file system, you can write to /proc/self/atto/exec and then it'll specify, and then you write to that the context you want to use for the next process you execute. Now, when you write to that, SE Linux will validate the context you've requested against the policy for the domain you're programmed running in, and if it determines that your domain can never launch a process in that context, that can be through not having an allowed domain transition rule to transition to the domain you requested, or it can be because you've requested a different user identity or role, and you haven't got the privileges necessary to change role or identity, which are fairly privileged operations. So in those cases, SE Linux will just fail the operation. So your attempt to write to that file will fail. And if you do this from a shell script, then you can evaluate the return code, dollars question mark, in your shell script to determine whether this is succeed or not. Now, if it succeeds, that doesn't necessarily mean the new process you launch will be in that domain. It can be that you've requested a certain domain, and your process is actually allowed to launch other processes in that domain, but not the process you're trying to launch. So it might be a policy rule, for example, for the login process. The login process is allowed to change your user domain for executing a shell. If the login process executes something other than the shell, the execution will fail, because it's allowed to execute a shell in another domain, but not the process trying to execute. So you're asking something equivalent to calling set UID to nobody or something. The answer to that in a general sense is no. In the original design for SE Linux, it was a design feature that there was no equivalent to the set UID system call. The reason for this is, if you have a program running at a high privilege level, such as the example you gave, and this program then calls set UID to go to a low privilege level, and it doesn't execute, it doesn't call exec, it will still have the memory address space of the old process, and it could, for all we know, it could have read the shadow file, and the shadow file could be in memory. And we don't know really quite what's in memory, and in most cases, even the author of the program doesn't know. When you're using library calls in libc, for example, or other libraries, you don't really know what these library calls are doing. And sometimes you'll call a library call, and you'll have some side effects that you weren't quite aware of, and without even knowing, you might get some secret information into your process address space, and then you execute some untrusted code, and you have untrusted code access to what is potentially secret information. So to be sure, the only way to be sure in Unix that you've cleared out your address space is to call exec. So in usual SE Linux design, the only way you could change your security context is by calling exec. So you had to execute another process. So this meant that if you did, for example, want to execute some code in a shared object, you could re-exec yourself, requesting the kernel run a new version of the same program under a different security context, and pass the program you execute a command line parameter saying to the effect of load a certain shared object and execute it. That's kind of ugly. But for the initial design of SE Linux, that achieved the goals. The problem that we had that forced a change of design is the file servers Samba and NFS version 4. I'll talk about Samba because it's an example I think people know most about. And NFS version 4 is still fairly beta and probably no one here has used it. In Samba, you have TCP connections used for sharing file data between client and server. So what normally happens in simple operation, a client logs on, gives a username and password in some hash or encryption mechanism, serves to the session, and they have a separate SMBD process to serve files to that session. This is fairly simple to do, and so we could, in theory at least, have the SMBD re-exec itself to change its SE Linux security context. So its context then matches the identity of the user that logged in by SMB. However, there's a more complex case. NT Terminal Server and possibly other SMB clients can have multiple users running across one TCP connection. So on an NT Terminal Server machine, you could have 100 people logged in at once running on different terminals, each of them under a different username, each of them mounting a file system via SMB. And so then you have 100 different connections coming through the one TCP socket and has to be shared by the one server process. And we had many long discussions about this and some fairly heated discussions about it. I had some ideas for ways of rewriting chunks of Samba to work with this and have it fork off data to trial process and things. And Tridge, among other people, didn't like it at all. And so eventually it was agreed that changing AC Linux was required to work properly with Samba and Interface Version 4. And it was actually the introduction of the Interface Version 4 servers that actually forced the decision. Because while Samba was the one exception to the rule, the people writing the kernel code didn't feel inclined to make a change for one program. Once there's two programs and maybe more to come, then they're felt obliged to. So now in AC Linux, you can write policy to specify that a certain domain can transition to certain other domains without calling exec. So there is no, it's not like setuid, where a process can call setuid, so it's a process running as root with capability setuid, can call setuid while with any uid at all, without a restriction. Not at all. So in AC Linux, a process can now, if policy permits it, change to a certain domain within a set of domains that the policy specifies. And it's quite valid for policy to specify only one-way transitions. So domain A can go to domain B, but not back. And so this could be used in such instances to allow perhaps a shared object to run. I'm not sure you'd really want to do this in the case of running code that you don't trust, so I think that would be a bit too risky. But if you're running but for the case of Samba, it works well. In Samba, what we're going to do is we're going to say, instead of reading files in the context of user A, we're going to read files in the context of user B. And just changing the domain for that does all we need. Because what we for Samba, we didn't really require changing the domain. All we required was something equivalent to set FSCID. So that's all it's been going to be used for. Have I answered your question? Okay. Do we have any more questions at this stage? Okay. Okay, I was coming to just going to describe some of the most important domains and types. One of the most important domains, of course, is kernel underscore t. It's used for kernel and for init before it re-execs itself. As I mentioned in my talk yesterday, init is the process that loads the security policy. Before init runs, there is no AC Linux policy loaded, and therefore AC Linux isn't active. So init starts running as kernel underscore t, will re-exec itself to change to the init underscore t domain. The automatic domain transition, and it will then continue the normal operation of the system. Unlabeled underscore t is for files and processes that have become unlabeled through the policy changes. So this means if you change a policy to remove the definition of a domain or type, then process running that domain or file in that type will have you change type to unlabeled underscore t. Also, of course, if you boot a machine up, and at boot time, the kernel first attempt to access the file discovers that its context doesn't match the security policy, then again we'll have unlabeled underscore t. Now, if you've got a process running, there's something come labeled unlabeled underscore t through loading different policy, that process will then only be given permission to send sigchild to init, so the process is effectively immediately dead. File underscore t is for files that have never been labeled. This is a file that lacks the attribute security linux, which is used for storing the file security label. Okay, here are some of the important attributes. Domain is used to group all the types that may be used for labeling processes. Priv log is assigned to all domains that can use syslog. So a domain that has that attribute is permitted to write to /dev/log and send data to the syslog D. The auth attribute grants read access to the shadow file. This is the programs into authenticate users. This is something you want to minimize use of as much as possible. And one thing we've been doing is changing the policy and programs to reduce the use of it. One example is that I made a change to PAM. In PAM, there is the PAM Unix authentication module, which is used for shadow file authentication. It's designed to be used from screensavers. So if you run PAM Unix to check a password under your own UID, which is used for a non-set UID screensaver to authenticate your password, the PAM code will try and open the shadow file. The open will fail because it's not running as root, of course. So it will then launch a trial process, Unix underscore chkpwd, set UID root program, which can read the shadow file and will verify the password that the sensor is on standard input against the username that matches your UID. So you only verify your password on the current UID. I changed this. In the actual PAM code, there was a check that said, if I can't open the shadow file and I am root, then I'll abort, which seems rather useless to me. So I removed this check entirely. So it just goes, if I can't open the shadow file, then I'll run this helper program. So now when SE Linux is running, if Linux doesn't commit programs such as /bin/login, even, to read the shadow file. So the /bin/login will call the PAM module. PAM module will try and open the file, file open files. So then it forks the child process, executes this Unix_chkpd program, which in addition to being set UID for Unix permissions, also has a type that calls a domain transition for SE Linux. So it transitions to a domain that has the auth attribute, and can then read the shadow file and verify the password. And this means that very few programs in SE Linux have read access to the shadow file. And one thing is on my to-do list is to change a bunch of other programs to use Unix_chkpwd. One example is, as far as I'm aware, every Unix Radius server will try and directly read the shadow file to verify passwords for the case of the default configuration in which you're using your regular Unix password and shadow password file to specify Radius users. So one thing I want to do is change the Radius server to call this setuid program, which will mean that the Radius server will not need root access, because the Radius ports are 813 or something, and these ports are above 1024, so no root access needed for that. So it means every Radius server could then run without root privileges, so even on non-SE Linux systems, security will be improved by this change. And on SE Linux, I can reduce by one the number of domains that's permitted to use to access the shadow file. Now, I mentioned before there's a program called APOL to analyze policy. This program is written by a company called Tresis, who've done a lot of work on SE Linux. And so this APOL program will read either the policy source or policy binary. I strongly recommend using the policy source because more information is available there. With the policy binary, it'll only tell you whether an operation is permitted or not. With the source, you can actually double-click on an operation that's been committed, and it'll bring up the source code for it and show you whether it's been committed via an attribute or via direct access. And also you can see comments in the policy.conf file. So you not only just see what access is granted, but you might see comments from the author of the policy indicating why access is granted. This APOL program, you can use it to perform queries on the policy. And one query you might want to do is ask it which domains are permitted to access the shadow file. And you get a list of domains back. And then you can ask it for each of these domains which executables are entry points for those domains. So for every domain, to enter a domain, you have certain executables that can be executed to enter it. And you can't enter the domain unless you execute one of these executables. So once you have a list of the executable types that can be used to enter these domains that can read the shadow file, you can then search through the file context and see which file specs match these types, and then find which of these file specs are actually on a system we want to audit. And that way we can get a list of every single process that can ever access a shadow file on this Linux system. Something you could never do with Unix permissions only being used. On a system running relying on Unix permissions, every process that runs as root can access the shadow file, and every process, that means every program which could be called by setuid program, which is pretty much everything, can read the shadow file as well. So it's hopeless trying to audit them. Last time I checked through analyze this Linux policy, there were about 30 different programs that were permitted to read the shadow file, or write the shadow file. 30 programs isn't that many. So if I wanted to spend a couple of months auditing source code, I could audit all these programs and be somewhat more satisfied that untrusted code couldn't get access to my shadow data on my systems through exploiting these programs. Whereas on a machine running on relying on Unix permissions only, this would be impossible. There would be no way of doing such an audit. Okay, another attribute I should mention this time, auth_chkpwd. This is used for a daemon domain which is permitted to run Unix_chkpwd to check a password. This is a convenience attribute because there are so many daemons that need to verify password, so I just add this attribute to each of them that needs it, and then I can do it safely. Another attribute is etc underscore writer. This is assigned to all domains that can write, have write access to the etc directory. The reason for this is writing to the etc directory is a very serious operation. So any program that can inappropriately write to the etc directory can be certain that it will be able to compromise the security of the system if it's exploited. So it's a fairly serious operation, something we want to allow easily and often. So we've got this attribute. I've got an assertion to prevent calls being compiled if programs that lack this attribute have such write access. And this is, of course, that when you're writing policy, if you've accidentally granted such access, you'll see the error message from check policy, and you hopefully think about what you're doing, and perhaps decide that you don't want to allow such access. The admin attribute identifies every administrator domain, so that's sys7_c. And file type identifies all regular types for files and disk. I'll move through this pretty quickly. Okay, the most common change that you're likely to make to the policy itself is defining new user roles and user identities. So there's a macro, form user role, which creates all the domains and types necessary for writing a new user role. So for example, if you're writing policy for a university server, you might have policy full user role, open brackets, professor, close brackets. And this will then isolate the professor's data and programs from those of the students who might be in user underscore role. And you want another one, full user role, open brackets, PhD, close brackets. So you have the PhD students spread off from the undergraduates and the professors as well. So this is a simple way of for isolating groups of users from each other. So there's no real limit to how many you could have. You could have hundreds or possibly thousands of different roles for regular user logins, if necessary. So at a university, for example, you have a role for each class if you wanted. And that way, when someone tries to hack you, they'll be from someone in your own class, and you know who to beat up. Now, when you define use this macro for user role, it will create the role for the user, which for the regular user is user underscore R. It will create the domain, which in the example would be user underscore T, and basic types for files. So it's user home DOT for the actual user's home directory, user home T for files and directories under the home directory, user TMPT for temporary files, and the others. Now, when you're adding a new user role, there's also a macro you have to edit called in user role, and this lists the names of all roles. This is a bit of a hack due to a limitation that's against policy, and this lists all roles for certain programs that can run in all user roles. For example, a password underscore T domain is permitted to be in all user roles, so every user can change their password. Should I just finish it up now? Or are you happy for me to keep going and give more detail? I know a lot of people have been leaving so far. Have everyone who wants to go early left already? Is that a finish up or keep going? Okay? Now, for the strict policy, this is a feature that, I mentioned before of user roles, only applies strict policy. For targeted policy, which is the default for Fedora and the only supported policy for Red Hat Enterprise Linux, you don't have user roles. All users run in the same security context, which allows all operations, because any restriction of operations on a user login session will decrease usability of the system. People then start to complain a lot, and a lot of administrators don't want to learn enough about SE Linux to be able to configure this properly. And some of you might have recall reading about SE Linux in Fedora Core 2, and how a lot of users were complaining a lot because they didn't understand SE Linux and they didn't want to understand. So with the target policy, they don't have to understand. They get some of the benefits, benefits the most risky demons, and for the user sessions, that they have no restrictions, so they're happy. For the strict policy, we want to have limits on programs running user session to protect secret data and to restrict access to dangerous programs. So one example is the GPG program has your GPG secret key, which is a very important file which you never want to allow to escape. So what we want to do is restrict access to this file because it's so important. On the other hand, IRC clients are known for having security holes. To run our IRC clients in a less privileged domain, so that it can't overwrite critical files such as your .bash RC file if it gets compromised. So we have within a user role we have domains that are used in various programs. So one example is GPG. So I'll just briefly cover the policy used for GPG as an example of how to write a policy for a subdomain of a user's role. Now, so the first file is we've got a file domains program gpg.c. In this instance policy, policy files have the extension .c for type enforcement. This is a naming convention. Policy compilation process won't compile files that have different extensions. So this file has only one line that matters, a type declaration for type gpg.xxc. So it's got the attribute file type, because it's a regular file. It's a 7 file, because the administrator can write to it. And exec type. Exec type is the attribute for an executable that can be the entry point for a domain. So in this case, gpg.xxc is the entry point for domains used for running gpg. Now we've got another policy file, filecontext/program/gpg.fc. That's the file context file. So the file context files have the extension .fc by convention. And that has regular expressions that map to security kinds of files. Home_dir in capitals is a special string that there's a program that processes this and replaces home_dir with the full path of the user's home directory for each user who is in the SLM's policy. So if you have, say, two users in the SLM's policy, this line will be replaced by two lines which specify the actual home directory names of these two users. So the real expression specifies a directory named .gnupg and any files that may be under it. And the context it applies is system_uidentity, object_role, because roles don't apply for files on disk. And role in capitals is another special string that's replaced by the role for the user. So if in the user's file, I'll get to it in a second, if in the user's file the user identity is configured to have the role user_r as default role. Role will be replaced by user, so we become user_gpg_secret_t. If the user's default role is staff, it will be staff_gpg_secret_t. A question? In turn, yes. Yes. This is actually a bit of an annoyance at the moment. Say, for example, I've got a running SLM system. I want to add a new user. I want to give this new user an SLM identity. Okay. So I add the to the policy. I add the identity. Firstly, I add the user using userAdd. So it creates the user's home directory and creates the password file entry, etc. Then I add the identity to the user's file, which I have to compile a policy to load that. And at the same time, that will regenerate the file context file to have the entries. Then after that, I have to run restore con on the user's home directory to give the appropriate context for the user's home directory. It's a little annoying. Eventually, we'll have to devise some method of having a single operation to add the user's identity to the user's file, compile the policy, and relabel the home directory and run userAdd at the same time, just to save effort. Now, the other line in the file context file, we're labeling the GPG binary itself as having type gpg.xxc. This is the entry point for the GPG domains. Now comes the tricky part. We've got a macro file for defining a user role. It's macros/base user macros.t, and that contains the base macro definitions for the user role. And we have a conditional rule in this. So if gpg.c is defined, this is because if you don't want to use gpg on a machine, the way you would configure SELinux to not have gpg policy, you would just rm the t file or move it somewhere else. And so then the policy compilation process first generates an M4 file that defines macros for each of the names of t files that exist in the policy. And then we have ifdef rules that call macros only if they're to be used. Otherwise, you might be referring to types that haven't been defined in the policy and policy completion with abort. So we're saying if we define GPG.c, so if we have this file in a policy, we then call macro GPG domain. $1 in this case, $1 is M4 syntax for the first macro parameter. So the parameter we pass to GPG domain macro, where the first parameter is passed to the full user role macro, which in the case will be user, staff, 7, or in the case of a university example I used before, professor or PhD. Now, in the file macros/program/gpg-macros.c is where the macros are defined for the GPG domain. So in the core, the first part of it is defining macro itself. So we have within the M4 quotes the name GPG domain, and then within quotes we have the actual policy itself, the macros to expand to. Now, the next file, I'll show that the contents of this macro. Oh, sorry, an abridged version of content. So I only show the things actually really important, not some of the trivial stuff that I'm taking all day to explain, not really informing much. Okay, so the first thing we want to do is declare the domain. So type $1_GPG_C. So this will be user GPGT with the attribute domain, so the domain for a process, and priv log, because GPG will often try to log things as log. To say set your program so if it believes something's going wrong, it'll log things. So now we define a type for the secret files in the user home directory. So this will expand to user GPG secret C. And it's a file type, it's a regular file. Home dir file, it's a file under user's home directory. And it's a sysadmin file, which means that the administrator can write to it directly. And now we define a role. We define the domain to be in the role. So we're saying role, user_role. We'll have the domain user_gpg_c. If it wasn't this definition, the user couldn't run GPG program because the domain transition would result in an invalid context. Now I want to permit the transition. So the rule domain auto trans, source domain is user_t. When user_t executes the type gpg_exec_t, it transitions to user_gpg_c. And now we want to allow the user to see the process and PS output. So we allow user GPGT and, we have the rule can PS to allow the PS to see the process. It's really annoying if you have someone run a program and they can't even see that the program's running. So can PS, user_T, can see user_GPG_T. And so we want to allow send signals to kill up the process if necessary. To allow user GPGT and user T to access user GPGT for the object class of process for inter-process communication and access signal. And now we want to allow the domain to use the terminal device for the user. So we allow user GPGT access to two types. User dev PTST, which is used for pseudo TTYs. That'll be a TTY created by an extern or by screen or another user process, or via SSHD for a remote login, and user TTY device T. User TTY device T is the type that's used for labeling a virtual console if user logs in the virtual console. So if user logs in via /bin/login, then /bin/login will relabel the terminal such that only their domain or only their role can access it. And the object class for this is character file, character device node, and we're allowing rewrite file perms, so full access. And finally, we allow user GPGT access to the attribute privfd. Privfd represents every domain that creates a file handle that's widely inherited. So it's used, for example, for a login session. Privfd applies to login and SSHD, and so the file handles they create will be used by many processes. And also, TTY device. The serial port is labeled the same way as a virtual console. This is an issue that can be a little annoying because trying to find a way of handling serial consoles as serial ports or as login sources is kind of difficult. Currently we treat them as the same. I'm not sure that's what we want to intend or to continue doing for a strict policy, but something we're still considering what to do with. they run the label the same way. And also, they're all in the same method. You have Getty creates the opens the file handle, and it's inherited by everything else. Okay, now for the core access of GPG. The macro users underscore shlib grants access to use libc6 and other shared other common shared objects. Can network allows network access because GPG wants to be able to download public keys from the internet. Now comes the tricky part. When the domain user GPGC for the GPG process creates the GPG configuration directory, you want to label it as user GPG secrecy. So we've got a rule, file.autotrans, which is used for for creating a file and having it automatically be in a different type to the type of the directory. By default, when a file is created, it will be created with the same type as the type of the directory it's in, or a process can request a different type. But in this case, the process will not request any different type, and there will be an automatic type transition when the file is created. So user GPG type, the first parameter, it creates a file on the directory of user home DOT, and the last parameter is the object class, which is directory being created, and the third parameter is the target context, which is user GPG secrecy. You probably noticed the order is slightly confusing. The third and fourth parameters are probably in the wrong order. The reason is the fourth parameter was a more recent development. Originally, this macro only took three parameters. And when I changed it to take four parameters, I didn't feel inclined to go through every bit of policy that I'd written and change it all around and then have to deal with people still writing new policy and using the old syntax and left in perhaps a bad order. Now, we want to allow user GPGC to have read-write access to the directory and to create files of the same type. So it means they have full access under that directory. So the macro rwda create file gives read-write access to the directory and allows creation of files in that directory with full access to those files, and incidentally symlinks, even though they're not really used. So user GPGT has full access to the directory and files under it for user GPG secrecy. Now, the next thing we want to do is allow the GPG process to read files created by the regular user and write output files in the same context. So that means if you instruct GPG to decrypt a file and write it out to a certain file name, the file will be readable by the user. We don't want to be secret. So we have file type autotrans again. So user GPGT creates a file in the user's home directory, user home DOT, and it's for regular file, and it's going to transition to user home DOT, the type for regular files in the user home directory. And we have a similar rule for temp directory. So under TMP directory, it's TMP underscore T, the file type will be user TMPT, the same as for any other file you might create there. Okay, we're back to the ABC messages. I mentioned before the audit to allow program. So on the screen here we've got an example of the output of the audit to allow. So this would rule be allow user underscore C access to EDC underscore C class directory access write. I'll get to it in a second. This won't compile. I mentioned before we've got assertions, and one of these never allow rules says to never allow domains that lack the auth write attribute to the EDC writer attribute to write that directory. So if you were just learning about SE Linux and you ran into audit to allow, you might decide to just allow this operation. So you put this in a policy, try and compile it, and a compilation process would fail. Then you would start to think about it, and you think, well, is this really what I want to do? And you probably decide you actually don't want to do that. And what would have happened here is that a novice administrator would have logged in as the wrong role, tried to do some administrative task, which is editing the password file, and then had it rejected because he used the wrong role. Solution, use the correct role. Another possibility of this, of course, is someone logged into a machine, such as my Excellence Play machines online, and they've logged in and only get the user privileges, and of course they're not permitted to write the EDC directory at all. Now, good question? If your backup is EDC Linux aware, then the context will be restored. You're correct this, yes, you'll lose the labeling. Yes, there's a program called RestoreCon to be used to restore the context of the file to the default as specified by the policy. So in this case, the labeling that the file automatically gets matches what the policy, the file context file specifies, so RestoreCon will do it. So what you might do is label the user's home directory. If you're restoring from backup, you label the user's home directory such that nothing can access it, nothing other than administrator. You do the restore, then you run RestoreCon minus capital R for recursive to tell it to restore the context of the entire directory tree. And then it'll all be done. Yeah. Yeah. STAR has been modified to have AC Linux attribute support. So if you use STAR for backups, then it will just work. Also, no, the backup domain can read it, and also the administrator. So your backup, will, depending on how you do backups, you'll be running one of two domains: backup _t or system _t. Either of them can read all files, so you've got no problems. But also another option, of course, is to use LVM snapshots for backup. And again, the backup domain can read the raw block device and does everything you want to do. LVM snapshots, I think, are a very good option for backups nowadays. It's fast, it's easy, it's consistent, and you just avoid a lot of the issues. So there's no issues of does your backup program support AC Linux attributes, etc., because everything's supported on the file system. The only downside is that if you want to restore just one or two files to the backup, you've got to then mount the file system somewhere and just copy them across. So LVM snapshots are good for restoring an entire machine, not good for restoring a few files. Depending on what your requirements are. For my machines, I just use LVM snapshots because what I'm worried about is the hard disk dying entirely and losing my data. Depends what you're concerned about. Well, okay, you've got slightly different requirements there. Okay, I mentioned poison.